right, it's 3 o'clock now. Let's get started. To begin with, are there any questions from last week's lecture talking about data representation? How do you represent what in a file system?
The end of file.
If you want to store a, well, we're going to talk a little bit about how you store text or typical ways of representing text. And one of these techniques that's used for strings, which I'll talk about in just a minute, this one here, is sometimes used for files as well. But there are a variety of different ways in which you could represent files on a disk. I'm sorry? It can depend a lot on the file system, yes. So I should say if you want some, several things. For the material from last lecture, as with all the lectures, there is accompanying reading, and I strongly encourage you to work through that reading as well. So that's on the schedule webpage for the course. Currently still we've got last year's pages up there, but so far everything's extremely similar to last year, so all that stuff is still relevant and current. But there it kind of points you to the reading you should be doing. Also too, coming up next week we'll have the first tutorial session, and accompanying the tutorial session there's a tutorial worksheet, and I encourage you now to start working through that worksheet. That will give exercises covering this material from this lecture last week on data representation. So if you come to tutorial prepared with having worked through some problems, maybe having had some difficulty with those problems, then that will make the tutorial much more valuable to you and to the others in the group as well. All right, today what I'd like to do is just finish read this last slide from last week, and then we're going to move on to the topic of assembly language programming, so teaching you in two lectures a new programming language. It can be done. It will be done. All right, so we talked last week about how to represent integers and how to, very briefly, how to represent floating point numbers. Here in one slide, we're just going to touch on how you represent characters and how you represent strings. So we encode numbers in binary. We have to encode characters in binary as well. Now, typically, the kinds of operations we do on characters aren't as complicated. We don't multiply characters together. We don't add them. However, we still do some things with them. We like to know when one character is before another character in the alphabet, for example. We need this if we want to sort names of things and put them in alphabetical order. Kind of a very common encoding of characters into binary is called the ASCII representation. Each character is held in a byte, and so the character 0 representing the number 0, kind of printed 0, is actually the character, the hex character. So remember, 0x is the prefix we use to indicate the number's hex rather than decimal or some other base. So 0 character is in hex, the number 30. The character for capital A is the hex number 41. And little a is 61. So ASCII typically uses just 7 bits as an extended ASCII character set, which uses 8 bits. That certainly provides you with 256 characters and also a few codes for other things, like there's a special code for new line, saying that your text should begin a fresh line. And there's another one saying that when you get to the end of a string. Typically, though, kind of around the world, there are many different alphabets, and 250-odd characters is a huge restriction. So, for example, we have this Unicode character set, which uses 16 bits to represent characters. So here, one can represent a much, much wider range of characters, so cover characters from most or all of the world's major languages. Then once we've got a coding for characters, we can put together sequences of these binary words for each character to form strings. So you've seen the string data type when you've been programming in Java last year. So words or sentences are just strings of characters. And so here, of course, when we have this notion of character, we have some characters too, which are white space. I mentioned a new line. You also have a character which represents a single space as well, so that you can space out your words. And there are various conventions on how we indicate where the end of a string of characters is. One convention is that when we store a string, we just store a special character as the very last, or just beyond the last character in a string. In the C language, if you're programming in any language based on C, then in C there's a basic data type of characters where the strings are terminated just with what's called a null character, which has the hex code 00 here. One other convention is to say that a string is an array of characters, and we keep the length of the string as a separate piece of data associated with the array of characters for the string itself. This is what happens in Java. So each of these design choices has its pros and cons. Right now, current thinking is that this approach, say taking Java, is far superior, because immediately if we say we want the fifth character from a string, and that string's only got two or three characters, very quickly we can say, well, actually, there is no fifth character to that string, and we can do something special in that situation. If we've got these null terminated strings as in C, then we've got to search to the end of the string before we actually know whether indeed we can access a fifth character or not. I mean, if the string's only two or three characters long, that's not much trouble to get to search the end. But if your string was 100,000 characters long, then it might be a bit of a hassle to search the end, only to find that you've been asked for the millionth character, and indeed there is no millionth character. So that's kind of one reason why this might be better. Also, too, it turns out that many security vulnerabilities in current computer systems can eventually be traced back to this decision here, that this idea of allowing strings which are just arbitrary lengths of arbitrary sequences of characters terminated by null, rather than having the length stored with the character. So this decision at the time, this decision was taken back in, I think, the 70s. At that time, they didn't really realize the consequences of the decision, but it's been a real headache for people involved in computer security in certainly recent years and last couple of decades. All right, so this is just a brief introduction to how we also can store, how we can represent characters and strings of characters in binary. But now to start on the main topic for this lecture, which is to get you, introduce you to the concept of assembly language programming. All right, so we're going to have a look at an example of a processor's native language. So this is the real language that the hardware understands. And in doing so, we're going to be looking at what it says here is the most important software-hardware interface. So one theme of this course and a theme of the set text for the course, this Patterson and Hennessy textbook, is that what we're looking at is how software and hardware interact, how they interface with each other. And the instruction set is really one of the core places where the two interact. we're going to be looking at a particular an instruction set called MIPS. It's got this acronym. We don't really care at this stage why it's got that acronym. We'll just take it as given that this is a nice, simple, reasonably simple instruction set to study. If you want to read more about it, and you will do because there'll be a coursework based on it soon, you can pop along here and pick up this document here. This is an appendix from an older edition of the Patterson and Hennessy textbook. It still exists in the current edition. It might have changed slightly, but for our purposes, the copy of this from any edition is absolutely fine. This probably goes into more detail than we really need, and on the web page, and as and when you need it, I'll kind of point out which sections you can safely ignore and which ones you should focus on. But I'd encourage you already after this lecture to just pop down there and have a browse and start reading some of the first material in this chapter, assuming you haven't got the book itself. All right, so what are we going to talk about? So between today and Friday, we look at looking at the basic instruction set, looking at instructions for doing arithmetic and logical operations like ANDing and ORing the bits in logical words. We'll be looking at the basic structure of the memory inside the processor itself, the registers, and looking at how you get data to and from those registers and the main memory. Go on to look at control flow instructions. So these are the instructions you use to implement branches and loops and things like that. And finally, we'll get to the basis of how you implement method calls and what's actually going on at the assembly code level when you jump from one procedure to another procedure in, say, a language like Java. Let's get stuck in. Move on to processor instructions. So we talk about instruction sets being the collection of all machine instructions recognized by a particular processor, a really family of processors that kind of here, well, I mentioned a week ago this ARM instruction set. So actually out there are probably literally thousands of different ARM designs, but they all recognize the same instruction set, and that means the same compiler can be used to prepare code for them. But generally, yes, we have a kind of collection of similar processors with a given instruction set. So this abstracts away from the hardware details, so abstracts away from the difference between each of these thousand implementations of the ARM, for example. And kind of abstraction is always key and wonderful in computing because it makes things tractable, which otherwise would be extremely tedious. If we know about instruction set and we're programming it, we're creating a compiler, we're given an instruction set, we don't need to know how that instruction set is actually implemented. We just need to know the description of that instruction set itself. So very powerful abstraction. The IS is a very powerful instruction barrier. Then we might have these thousands of different implementations, but we often have what we call an ISA, instruction set architecture. So this is a generic, probably rather ideal, maybe rather naive implementation of a processor which recognizes a particular instruction set. It's very useful because it kind of helps you understand what these instructions are doing. And if you were to create a real processor, maybe you would start with one of these ISA models. Typically, however, in processors today, there's a lot more going on underneath the bonnet than you actually see at the kind of ISA level. However, the beauty is, for the most part, you really don't care about what's going on there because it provides this very powerful abstraction barrier. All right. So these, if we're kind of trying to classify instruction sets, very broadly we have we can talk about what are now called reduced instruction sets and complex instruction sets. So what's the difference between the two? It's kind of, it's to do with the how much you're asking each instruction to do. And there's an example here at the bottom. So with a reduced instruction set, what we do is we have fairly simple instructions that don't do too much. So for example, let's consider code that, consider how we might compile this statement here that we might write in Java or C or some other high-level language. So make the variable A equal to the value of the variable B plus some constant 10. If we were coding for compiler or we're compiling this code or we were coding by hand into a RISC architecture, we might end up with something like this. We might say, well, we've got these registers named R2, R3, R4, R5. And we break this down into three instructions. Let's don't worry too much about memorizing what's going on here, but we're actually seeing an example of MIPS, of instructions from the MIPS instruction set. But here what we're seeing is we're saying, well, register R2 contains an address of variable B, and what we're going to do is we're going to load the contents of that address into register R4. Now what this add instruction says is take the contents of register R4, add the constant 10, store that in register R5. And now this is a store word instruction that says store the contents of register R5 into the memory location at the address which is in the contents of register R3. So we're breaking down what we think, what we write, just as that, into kind of some more elementary steps which a processor itself might understand. If we're working with a complex instruction set, we might have a single instruction which can encompass the effect of these three instructions here. We might be able to, so with a MIPS instruction, with a MIPS or a RISC architecture, one basic principle is if we're doing arithmetic operations, we can only do these on the contents of the registers inside the processor itself. We have to do this transfer of data to and from memory and registers separately. But with a complex instruction set, we're allowed to, you have to kind of do the transfers and the operation together. So this, for example, might be how we take data from the address pointed to by R2, we add 10 to it, and we store that back at the address which is stored in register R5. So, let's see, do we, yes. So just a kind of one or two more words about this. So the x86 architecture, which is kind of running on most desktops, is an example of a CISC, a CISC. However, the things like the MIPS are an example of a reduced instruction set. Now, these days, if you talk to a computer architect, he or she will universally prefer to create an architecture for a RISC instruction set. It's the reason being that it just makes their life much simpler and they're much more powerful optimizations that they can do. However, in this world we live in, a strong importance is placed on being able to run legacy code. And for that reason, this x86 architecture has lasted much, much longer than it would have for any other reason. And what the architects have had to do is essentially, on the fly, inside their CPUs, they take in these complex instructions and they actually translate them inside the CPU into simpler RISC-like instructions. So they're doing that on the fly. So they've got their own little compiler written in hardware that's interfacing between instructions being read from memory and the actual processor, the kind of the guts of the processor itself. And they do it and they moan and they groan, but they do it because they have to maintain this backward compatibility. All right, so what I showed you there was some kind of, I'll show you a language that we call assembly codes. So this is different from the ones and zeros that the processor is actually going to read from memory when it wants to see these instructions here. So kind of going from that assembly code to actually the ones and zeros that the computer understands is then a kind of additional extra step that we go through. However, from our point of view, we never want to see instructions written out in hexabinary, or almost never, because it would be an incredible laborious process to both prepare code in that way and then to read code that way. So typically, we work at this assembly language level where for each assembly language instruction, there's one, sometimes maybe two, real machine code instructions which the processor itself understands. So yes, I don't use this phrase machine code, but sometimes we talk about machine code being the zeros, the instructions written out in binary, and we talk about assembly language when we're talking about those mnemonic codes that we saw on the previous slide, and we'll see lots more examples of coming up. All right, following our agenda, we're going to kind of walk through the main families of instructions that we might see in a RISC architecture. In particular, we're going to use the MIPS IS as a running example. So here, starting to look at operations that work on data. So remember, as I was saying, with the RISC architecture, we're working on data that's stored in registers. So here, the RISC, the MIPS instruction add ABC is, so A, B, and C are, in this case, not arbitrary variable names from a program, but they're names of registers inside the CPU. And this is a way in which we say, make the value in register A equal to the value in register B plus the value in register C. Similarly, here the subtract instruction says, make the value in register A equal to the value of register B minus the value in register C. So we've got this basic pattern spelled out at the top here, operation destination given first, and then the two operands, two arguments to the operation given after that. Question?
Are we in place additions
and subtractions alone? Yes, so if you wanted to, you could say A equals A plus B, and you could then say add AB. That would be completely legitimate, yes. So we can also do bitwise logical operations. So say our registers are 32-bit registers, then a bitwise logical instruction says, take bit 0 from one argument and bit 0 from the other, take bit 0 from one argument to take it from the other argument, and then store the result of, say, anding those into bit 0 of the result. And then similarly do that for all the other bits in the word. So that's what we mean by bitwise logical operation. And typically we have operations and OR and exclusive OR supported. Everybody knows the difference between normal OR and exclusive OR? Anybody need a refresher? Just in case. So exclusive OR, so I'll just draw the truth tables. So say we've got inputs A, B, 0, 0, 0, 1, 1, 0, 1, 1. We take OR A, B, then the OR of A, B is 1 just when either of A and B is 1, so that's 0, 1, 1, 1. The exclusive OR of A and B is a 1 just when one of the arguments is a 1, but not both of them. So truth table there is 0, 1, 1, 0. So that's the difference between normal OR and exclusive OR. Exclusive OR is a very useful operation because it allows us to do things like selectively flip bits of a word. If we for say if we've got an input B2, B1, B0, and we XOR that with 0, 0, 1 bitwise, then what this says is essentially flip the 0th bit, keep the first bit the same, and keep the second bit the same. So we, by choosing different numbers here with ones in different positions, we can choose to flip different bits in the input. So that's one use for exclusive OR. We then have shift instructions. We talked about the operations of shifting last week. Here, SHAMT stands for shift amount. And here we're using notation commonly used in C for shifting, for shifts left and shifts right. Here, these are the logical shifts. These are shifts that always shift in zeros. And we have the shift right arithmetic. I forget the code for it, but there's another code which will duplicate the most significant bit when you're shifting right, which is the right one you want to use, as I said last week, if you're doing signed arithmetic and you're wanting a shift which corresponds to roughly dividing by 2, or dividing by 2 to the power of the number of bits that you're shifting. So logical shifts, left and right. All right, so that's just a kind of taster for kinds of operations that one can do. Let's talk a little bit about registers. So as I was saying, with the RISC instruction, when you're doing operations, you're only allowed to do those operations on values which are stored in the registers. You can't do adds and subtracts on values out in memory in a single instruction. So I kind of assume that you roughly had some idea about what a register is, but it's like the collection of registers in a CPU, in a processor, are a form of very small memory which the processor itself can very quickly access. So a register is an internal storage location inside a CPU holding the value, holding some, say, 32-bit or 64-bit value. The size of the register typically is equal to the size of the typical word that the processor is handling. Up till recently, the typical size for most processors was 32 bits. More and more now, the registers are actually 64 bits in size. MIPS architecture might have a 64-bit extension, I'm not sure, but certainly for the purposes of this course, all the words handled by MIPS CPU are 32 bits. And a final remark is that there aren't many of these registers typically, so in a MIPS processor, there are just 32 of these registers. The registers are interchangeable for many purposes. Registers don't have, most of the registers don't have dedicated uses. However, there are conventions that we use when we're programming in MIPS that help us create assembly code that works with other assembly code that's already been written. What we do, so the registers say are numbered between 0 and 31, but it's a bit confusing just referring to a register by number, so we invent different names for the registers. So for example, there are registers with names $S0 to $S7 that we use for holding values of Java or C variables that might be being used very commonly in a particular part of code that we're compiling. If we just need a temporary variable for a very short length of code, we might use these registers which are named with these T variables, so $T0 up to $T9. So, as I said, each of these names corresponds to a number, but we just don't, you can look up what that number is, but you don't really care what that number is. It's kind of easier to read assembly code when we refer to these names here. Not all the registers are completely the same. So we say that register 0 actually is a kind of dummy register. Its value is always hardwired to the value 0. As we'll see shortly, this comes in use in some instructions. And there's some other registers too, which have one or two special roles. We'll see those perhaps later. In addition to these general purpose registers, these kind of data registers, there's a special register inside the CPU called the program counter. And this is what keeps track of where your program is at any one time. So it kind of keeps track of the next instruction that's going to be fetched and executed. All right, start looking a bit more about, a little bit more at the structure of instructions and different kinds of instructions. So there are instructions which take a constant as part of the instruction. And we call this constant often an immediate operand. And we then use the suffix I for the name of the instruction. So here this says, take the value in R2, add the immediate value n to it, and store the result into register R1. So usually this instruction here fits into a 32-bit word, and this instruction allows 16 of those bits to be used to describe that number n. And so, for example, here's the effect of, if we just want to load a small number into a register, here's how we can achieve that using actually an add instruction rather than having to have a separate load instruction. So here what we're doing is we're going to exploit this fact that register 0 is always hardwired to 0. So if we add a small constant to the value of register 0, all we're doing is taking that small constant and then putting it somewhere. So for example, if we add n to the value in register 0 and we store that in register S0, then that's the same as doing an assignment like this, where here now let's be a bit more specific about what we're doing with bits. Here we're saying bits 15 to 0 of register S0 get the value n, and then bits 31 to 16 of S0 get the value 0. So if you remember, already here we've got a convention about how we're numbering bits, and this is one that we saw yesterday as well, that when we write out a binary word, say if it's a 32-bit word, then the most significant bit we write as bit 31, and the least significant bit we write to be count as bit 0. This way of numbering bits is not universal, and actually we'll look at an example of actually sometimes where it's reversed. So if you're coming to a completely new CPU architecture, you often just have to check right at the start how are people numbering their registers, their bits of their words. So back to this example. So what we're seeing here is how you load a small value into a register without having to have that value out in memory somewhere, how that value can be incorporated as part of the instruction itself. Typically, although this is kind of the way in which we do it, this isn't the most kind of obvious mnemonic to use for doing this. It's a bit crufty. It's a bit kind of exploiting a particular feature of the architecture. So what we do is we allow you to, that the assembler allows you to write what are called pseudo instructions. So you can say load immediate this register with this constant value. And then what happens if the constant value is small, if it can fit into 16 bits, then this pseudo instruction is translated into just this instruction here. However, the same pseudo instruction will work if you put in a constant which is larger than a size that will fit into 16 bits. In that case, what's actually generated by the assembler program which creates the machine code is essentially code for two instructions that will look like this. So what this is, this first instruction says load upper immediate with this value here. So by upper it means the we talk about the lower bits, so the lower 16 bits and the upper 16 bits of a 32-bit word. So this is saying put into the upper 16 bits the value n1, so that's what we're seeing here, and then just make the lower 16 bits the value 0. And now, let's use an OR immediate instruction to bring in a value N2 into the lower 16 bits without affecting the upper 16 bits. So what we're seeing here is a use of the OR instruction to kind of selectively set some bits of a word without touching the other bits. So here, the OR instruction doesn't touch the upper bits, but only affects the lower bits. So again, if we're looking at this concept of a mask, if we're doing an OR operation, just kind of aside more generally, we're just doing an OR operation, and we've just got bits 2, 1, and 0. If we OR with this, what we get is bit 2, bit 1 just staying the same as before, but then a 1 here forces this to be a 1. So an OR operation, especially when you're ORing with an immediate value, what's sometimes called a mask, is a way of introducing ones, forcing certain bits of a word to be 1 and leaving the other bits unchanged. Similarly, you can use an AND operation. So what do you think you could use an AND operation for? Similar to this. Any volunteers?
Setting bits to 0.
Exactly, yes. So if we did a AND here, then what that would do would be to set this bit to 0, this bit to 0, and leave this bit unchanged. So ANDing and ORing and XORing can be used for these different kinds of bit manipulations. Let's go on. Let's start looking now at how data is stored in memory and how we get data from memory into registers and then out again. For example, let's say you've written a Java class, maybe something like this, and in this Java class you've declared two 32-bit variables. And now what you do is you keep a... you've created a new object of this class using a new construct, and you've called it myobj. And now what you do is you've got somewhere in your code, you've got a statement which says make the variable temp equal to the value in the var2 field of the object myobj. So what's actually going on in memory here? So on the right here, we've got one way of writing out what we call a memory map. So this is a picture of what the computer's memory looks like. Now, for convenience, what we've done is we've decided that kind of each line in this picture is going to be a location where we can store one word, a 4-byte quantity, a 32-bit quantity. However, we find it very convenient when we're talking about addresses in memory, not to talk just about word addresses, but to talk about byte addresses. So word is, remember, 4 bytes in this case. So for that reason, our first location is called location 0, but then our next location is not location 1, but it's called location 4. And the next location again is location 8, and so on. So this is because it's convenient to have addresses refer to bytes, even though when usually talking about, well, we're commonly talking about 32-bit quantities being stored in memory, so we'd like to draw pictures which are like the following. And typically, so when we're storing an object in memory, typically we arrange it that the data for the different fields of that object are stored next to each other. So here, we might have it that this register S2 contains the address of this object. The address contains the address which is stored in this variable here. I don't know how much you went into this when you studied Java, but in Java, when you've got a variable here which refers to an object, really what's the value stored in that variable is the address of that object in memory, what's often called a reference to that object. And so here this register S2 holds the address at which this object is stored, and so say holds points to an address which say holds the value of var1, the var1 field, and then right after that is the value is a location in memory holding the value for the var2 field. So that's set in words over here. And now to execute this instruction here, what we're going to do is we're going to do a load word. Now let's see, so quite a few things are going on here. What we're wanting to do is fetch into the CPU the value stored in, fetch into a register, the value stored in this location here. So that's not the location pointed to by S2, but it's S2, the value of S2 plus 4. And that's what's going on here. This is the way in which we say an instruction, consider the data at address pointed to plus at the address pointed to by the value stored in S2 plus 4, and then stick that value into register T1. So this is how we might write it out. We might consider memory to be one vast array. And this is a bit of a, it's not, we're kind of writing using memory, using array syntax here. That's a little bit of a fudge because of this difference between words and bytes. Now what we're doing here is we're giving a byte address of a word. So $S2 plus 4. But then we're understanding that actually the transfer that happens, even though we've got a byte address here, is a transfer of a whole word into the register T1. So this load word is pulling a whole word into memory from the byte address starting at from this byte address here. And we've got this syntax here for talking about, for kind of doing a little add to the value of an address stored in a register. So that's a load word instruction. We also have a store word instruction, which does the opposite. And if we really do care about just pulling in individual bytes, say we're working with strings represented using just ASCII, then maybe we just want to access single bytes, then there are separate load byte instructions. So here's a load byte. Here, can we see more specifically what's happening with the different bits? So we're accessing the byte at this address here, and we're storing that into the lower 8 bits of this register. And then the higher, in this case, the sign extension, assuming that 8-bit quantity actually is a 2's complement number, and we get sign extensions. So these bits here become the same as bit 7, the most significant bit of the bit of the 8-bit byte actually loaded. Now we've got a store byte instruction here. Now with a store byte, what's important is that we're just writing out a single byte. We don't write out some extension of that byte. We just write out the lower 8 bits or whatever stored in register R1 in this case. So one thing to notice here is with loads, as with those arithmetic instructions, we've got this transfer of data kind of from right to left. This here, this argument here is where the data is being stored. With a store, the transfer is in the opposite direction. So this is where the data has been taken from, and this is where in memory it's going to. So just watch that when you're programming in MIPS. Something else I want to warn you about, this may not make much sense yet, but never try putting a value of a register in for n here. This n here always has to be a literal constant, just has to be a constant. Unfortunately, some compilers for assembly are clever enough that if you put a register in here, they will actually work and stick in an extra arithmetic add instruction to compute the address that you want to load from or write to. But for the purposes of this course, this is the syntax that you want to be sticking to. All right, a little bit more about memory addressing. What we have here are pictures of memory. And these are a bit like the memory maps we saw a couple of slides ago. But this time, we're going to imagine that the words are... Go away. Ignore the text at the top. Let's just focus on the diagrams. So here we're going to imagine addresses going upwards now. So we've got our first word in memory and now our next word in memory. And now there's a question about how we actually number the bytes in those words. So and we've really got a choice. If this is our first word in memory, which byte is byte zero? Is it the byte on the left or is it the byte on the right? There's no correct answer to this. People have designed CPUs with both answers. We've designed it both ways. And we give names to these two approaches to the way in which we lay out the bytes of a word when we're addressing words in memory. So we say, this is the word at location zero. This is the word at location four. And if we're considering how the bytes of this word are actually laid out in memory, then the most significant byte we count as byte zero, and the least significant as byte three, if we're in what's called the big endian approach. On the other hand, if we're working with the little endian approach, which is typically the one used with x86 CPUs, for example, then byte zero is stored at location zero, byte one at location one, byte two at location two, and byte three, the most significant byte, at location three. So the important thing to gather here is that given we've got a word, if we want to store it, store the bytes of that word at different addresses, we've got two choices to make. We can make this choice here. We can kind of stack the bytes of the word up, starting with the most significant byte. Or we can follow this approach here, where we start with the least significant byte, when we're stacking those bytes up to store a word. So in words, we're kind of talking about up here, yes, memory is byte addressable. And there's this question of what we mean when we talk about the words being aligned or non-aligned. So far I've been talking about words which always start addresses which are a multiple of four. But sometimes you could actually allow a word to start at any byte address. And this is called a non-aligned word. And occasionally you get both. In general, if a word is not aligned, then, and you say, I want to load a word from this non-aligned address, from this address which isn't a multiple of four, then because the way memory is designed is that usually the data is coming in widths of at least 32 bits, then some kind of swapping round of bytes has to go on in the hardware. And often this is a bit slower. So sometimes you'll find instruction sets which kind of talk about, well, this instruction supports aligned addresses, and this instruction works with non-aligned addresses. And the one with non-aligned addresses will be slower because it's got to do, so the hardware has to do a bit more work to pull in that word. Any questions on that? This can be confusing when you hear about it first time.
Does the endian list also put the bits in each byte?
No. So typically we don't have a way of addressing individual bits in a byte. So actually the question doesn't really arise, that our addresses can only talk about bits. So only talk about bytes, sorry. They can't talk about individual bits. So when we're numbering the bits in a byte, most typically we always kind of talk about bit 7 being the most significant bit and bit 0 being the least significant bit. Anybody else got a question? Okay. Just a word about... So I alluded briefly to how these instructions might be stored as binary words. Let me In this slide, I'm a bit more explicit about that. So typically with the MIPS instruction set, what we'd like is that each instruction in its totality takes up a single 32-bit word. If you look at a complex instruction set, then sometimes you have instructions which have multiple words to them. And one of the things that makes a RISC instruction set simpler is that we have this basic rule that every instruction fits into one word. So here what we see is examples of how the different information in instruction is split up among those 32 bits. For example, we have what are called R-format instructions, register format. These are instructions which just work on registers, things like add or sub. Now, what we do is we say we've got, say, the first 6 bits are used to code which operation we want to do. Do we want to do an add or subtract or something else? We've then got 3 fields, each of 5 bits long, which talk about where we're going to pull our 2 operands from and where we're going to store the result. Then, for instructions which say do shifting, like these logical shift instructions we saw before, we have another 5 bits, which allows us to talk about the number of bits we'll actually do the shift by in a single instruction. And then finally, there's some more bits that sometimes we use for what's called a subfunction. Sometimes we have many instructions which have the same main opcode, and the way in which we tell them apart is we have different subfunction opcodes for them. So opcode is operation code. These are the bits, the opcode are the bits that actually code the kind of instruction that we're doing, whether we're doing an add, a subtract, a load word, a load byte, whatever. That's one example of how we pack the information for instruction into a word. Here's another example, what we call I format instructions. I for immediate, because a significant part of the instruction word is taken up by bits which are used for this immediate value. So for example, we've got this add immediate instruction is stored using instruction in this format here. Also, we saw this OR immediate instruction before. This would use the same format. In addition, these load word and store word instructions actually use, again, the same format. By reusing the same format, we're simplifying the requirements of anybody implementing the architecture. Again, if you kind of look at CISC instruction sets, you'll find that there isn't the same uniformity that we've got here. So with these kind of instructions, we only need to talk about 2 registers. So we only need 10 bits to talk about a register maybe we're pulling data from and a register we're putting data into. Or maybe when we're doing a load word, a register we fetch an address from, which would be here, and a register where we store the data eventually. And then we've got these 16 bits that allow us to talk about, just provide some data which will form part of the instruction operation. All right, time's up, and slides are up as well. What I'll do next time on Friday is I will continue on and finish these slides. We'll finish giving you an introduction to the MIPS instruction set. What I'll do shortly, so this may be a bit dry. What we've got for you is a lab which involves running a simple MIPS simulator. And there's some example simple programs that you can load into this simulator and execute and watch executing. And I've got to check that the details are completely up to date. There are some details for the lab from last year up there now. But I'll email you shortly when I know that everything works fine for this year. But if you do that lab, that will then introduce you to, I mean, I like to kind of try things out and try seeing some simple example programs. But also be very good preparation for you for the first assignment, which will be coming up in a week or two's time, which will involve programming in MIPS. So I'll give you a task of programming a couple of simple items, and you'll go away and write those MIPS assembly code programs from scratch, and then use the same simulator that's used in the lab to test your programs and show that they work. All right, thanks very much for today. Oh, sorry, one question.
Why
I've got to firm that up. So I will, as soon as I've got that up, I'll email around to let you know. But I need to make sure it's away from times of other labs. So I'll be trying to avoid